Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, March 20th, 2025. On the front page of the News Gazette is a photograph with the caption, "The family of Oakwood, the Young family of Oakwood with Murray State star Caitlin Young after Sunday's Missouri Valley Conference tournament win in Evansville, Indiana. Family enjoying Caitlin Young's remarkable college basketball journey. The miles are piling up on the Young family's silver Honda Odyssey minivan. Happy, successful miles. Dave and Connie Young and their sons Josh, Nathan, and Nathan drove it home late Sunday night from Evansville, Indiana. Earlier, they watched their favorite college basketball player, daughter's sister Caitlin Young, power Murray State University to a blowout win in the Missouri Valley Conference tournament title game. Caitlin was named tournament MVP. Oh man, what a weekend. Still trying to recover," said Dave Young, who is back to work Monday at the Danville Airport. He is an airplane mechanic. Murray State was tested in the semifinals by Drake before winning by 6 points. "The semi tried our patience," Young said. "We just milked it out. That's all we could do. The final, an 83-62 Murray State victory over Belmont, was much less tense for the Youngs. They were joined at the game by Caitlin's fiancé, Jaden Cox, and his parents. Another 8 Young supporters made the trip. We had a good showing. It was nice. She really appreciated all of that," Young said. Next stop for the Youngs in their trusty van, Norman, Oklahoma. On Friday, the family is making the 712-mile trip west for the opening round of the NCAA tournament. Number 11 seed Murray State, making the second NCAA appearance in school history, opens Saturday with Big Ten power Iowa at Oklahoma's Lloyd Noble Center. Tip-off is set for 11 a.m. Oakwood time, and the game can be seen on ESPN. It will be the first meeting between the two programs. They are obviously a great team. It will be a huge challenge for us," Dave Young said. "What do we have to lose? The winner will face the winner of Oklahoma-Florida Gulf Coast on Monday for a shot at the Sweet 16. Of course, the Youngs will be there. Wouldn't miss it. They have followed Caitlin during an amazing college career where she became the Racers' all-time leading scorer. She has 3,023 points. Pete Maravich territory. Ask your grandparents. Caitlin currently stands 14th on the NCAA Division I career scoring list. Iowa's Caitlin Clark is number one. When you see the names she's listed with, it's just unreal," family friend Justin Wells said. "He's right, women's basketball royalty. Jackie Stiles, Missouri State, Brittany Griner, Baylor, and Maya Moore, UConn, are just ahead of Young. If the Racers, who lead the nation in scoring, make a long tournament run, Young can climb into the career top 10. The Youngs have enjoyed every minute of it. It's been something we would never have imagined," Dave Young said. "It's been unreal, all the things we've been fortunate to do and follow her around." Last season, Caitlin broke the Murray State career scoring record. She did that and got rebound number 1,000 in a game in the WNIT at Southern Mississippi. This season, her number 31 jersey was honored at Murray State's CFSB Center. "That was hard to top," Dave said. "Oakwood has rallied around the Youngs. The town has been great as far as support," Dave Young said. Perfect spot. In hindsight, plenty of bigger schools missed on Caitlin, but the family sees it different. "Things were meant to be," Dave Young said. "Absolutely zero regrets. She loves it down there." Murray State coach Rochelle Turner started recruiting Caitlin early in her high school career and stuck with it. "The Youngs were impressed. We got to know the coaching staff really well before she committed," Dave said. "They were like her second parents when she was down there. Just couldn't ask for a better staff, better people." During Caitlin's career, Murray State moved from the Ohio Valley Conference to the more Oakwood-adjacent Missouri Valley Conference. That meant annual trips for the Young fans to nearby Bradley, Illinois State, and Indiana State. "Her home games were probably the farthest games," Dave said. "Murray State is 307 miles from Oakwood. We tried to go down as many times as we could. The Youngs made the long trip this season to Murray State's game at LSU. The racers stayed close until late. That was another great experience, Dave said. Caitlin has completed her communication degree. Caitlin has completed her communication degree at Murray State and is finishing her master's. Next year, she wants to continue her basketball career, most likely overseas. Happy reunion. Justin Wells and wife Amanda were at Evansville's Ford Center for Sunday's tournament final. Amanda taking pictures and Justin cheering her on. It's been a good run here, Justin said. Hopefully we've got another little run in us. Justin and Dave Young coached Caitlin early in her basketball career. She was a star for the Comets and has gotten even better in college. Why? The biggest challenge I've seen out of her is her confidence, Wells said. So much more knowledgeable about the game. It's been really neat to see the transition. Wells sees Caitlin leading her team and coaching the other players. For me as a coach, I love it, Wells said. Wells' daughter Aubrey and Caitlin played sports together at Oakwood. Aubrey's brother Brevin attended the game, too. We live less than a block away from the Youngs, Wells said. The kids grew up together. Agriculture Roundtable discussion focuses on likely impact of USDA program cuts. When it comes to the current uncertainty over federal funding, many people have been asking Mayor Diane Marlin the same question, what can we do as individuals? So what would you tell our constituents, she asked. Everyone wants to do something and say something, and the chaos is so overwhelming that it's hard to focus. We don't have the votes to change this, replied Governor J.B. Pritzker. What we do have is our voices in local communities and the stories that we can tell about the devastation that has occurred. It was with this aim in mind that Pritzker, U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski, Democrat Springfield, and Illinois Department of Agriculture Director Jerry Costello II held a roundtable discussion Wednesday afternoon at Sola Gracia Farm on how federal cuts and freezes have affected farming and conservation efforts. Sola Gracia works to increase affordability and access to healthy, fresh food for low-income individuals, said Director Tracy Barkley. About one-third of the farm's income comes from grant funding, and of that amount, half is from U.S. Department of Agriculture programs that are at risk. As it stands, Sola Gracia could lose almost $90,000 in 2025 alone. A great deal of its own money... And it has already spent a great deal of its own money on expenses. It expected it would be reimbursed, Barkley said. One local project that could be hurt is Sola Gracia Farms to School program, which is conducted with support from the Champaign-Urbana Public Health District. The program, which is largely supported by federal funding, has included developing gardens at Urbana schools, creating curriculum for local teachers, and distributing food items from Sola Gracia and other local farms to the school district. It takes this careful work to get these sustainable pieces in place, but right now we're feeling like we're cut at the knees, Barkley said, adding that she's afraid they may have to reduce programs or staff. In addition to Barkley and Sola Gracia manager John Williams, the panel has included leaders from the Land Connection, Prairie Rivers Network, Savannah Institute, and the Illinois Environmental Council. According to the governor's office, a variety of USDA programs that promote conservation, organic farming, renewable energy, and food assistance may be at risk or have already been affected. USDA officials have said that Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins is working with the Department of Governmental Efficiency to cut wasteful spending and save taxpayer dollars. In an official statement last month, Rollins accused the Biden administration of overregulations, extreme environmental programs, and failure to fight crippling inflation. We will honor our commitments to American farmers and ranchers, and we will ensure that they have the support they need to be the most competitive in the world, she said. While the focus of Wednesday's roundtable was agriculture and conservation, Budzinski and Pritzker said they are also worried about the security of funding for other programs as well, including Medicaid, Veteran Services, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Pritzker said Illinois stands to lose an estimated $11 billion from various federal funding sources, which would pose a serious challenge to the state's budget. We don't have $1 billion to fill in the gap, he said. Both he and Budzinski claim that the federal funding cuts are not actually about efficiency, but rather tax cuts for wealthy individuals and companies. They're looking for any financial offset they can find to pay for these tax cuts, Budzinski said. She said that her efforts to fight funding cuts have included trying to find colleagues who can speak directly to Rollins and join in amicus briefs on legal challenges to the Trump administration's actions. She added that lawmakers are gearing up to defend against further cuts. The Congresswoman also agreed with Pritzker that stories of local impacts should be promoted. These are really important agricultural programs, and we need to put a face behind them, she said. Costello said he's been hearing from lawmakers on the other side of the aisle who want to work together to fight what's going on at the federal level. That ultimately is how we're going to win, he said. When they speak up and speak out, that's going to make a big difference, but all of us, everybody, whatever party we belong to, needs to. Departments navigating carefully amid uncertainty. As federal rulings targeting universities and diversity programs continue to roll out, despite often later being blocked by legal proceedings, University of Illinois faculty members are facing uncertainty about what the future will look like. We have experienced both direct and indirect effects of these changes, said Adam Davis, head of the Department of Crop Sciences. From his position in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, Davis has seen one of the most high-profile local impacts of federal funding cuts with the termination of the Soybean Innovation Lab. He also said three probationary scientists had been dismissed from U.S. Department of Agriculture units that had been longtime collaborators with his department. The most important indirect effects include the uncertainty and risk associated with disrupted research funding processes, Davis said. We feel this uncertainty keenly as we prepare for field research during the upcoming growing season. Davis said his department is handling that uncertainty by being conservative in hiring and spending and attempting to preserve resources in general. Since President Donald Trump took office, he has signed dozens of his executive orders, many of which impact immigration, university funding and diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. Many of those executive orders have since been blocked by judges, making changes even more difficult to predict. Law professor Jason Mazzone, whose primary focus is constitutional law, said both Trump administrations have been good for his business. He's hearing from reporters with legal questions almost daily. There is also suddenly great interest among people who used to poo-poo constitutional law as just politics in separation of powers, due process, freedom of speech, federalism, the role of courts, and other important features of our Constitution, Mazzone said. In early March, Trump threatened via Truth Social, the social media platform he owns, to stop funding any university that allows illegal protests. He apparently made good on that promise by canceling grants to Columbia University due to the school's continued inaction in the face of persistent harassment of Jewish students. Teresa Barnes, professor of history and women and gender studies, called that action a disgrace, but also said that Columbia's treatment of its students during and after last year's pro-Palestine protests was a disgrace. American education is under heavy attack, Barnes said. The question for all university administrators now is whether they will actually defend free speech and free inquiry, which they have always said are cornerstone values of their institutions. As Audre Lorde memorably said, your silence will not save you. Brett Ashley Kaplan, a professor in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, said that research funding concerns apply to the humanities as well. As she and her colleagues apply for grants to the National Endowment for the Humanities or the National Endowment for the Arts, these organizations have been impacted by Trump executive orders against initiatives involving diversity, equity, and inclusion. Kaplan said she has also seen friends' talks canceled because they are considered DEI, and graduate students have lost job opportunities because departments aren't hiring due to uncertainty. In other words, the strong and inescapable sensation of dread and anxiety has chilled or outright stopped much important research and work, Kaplan said. She said the Trump administration fears the universities because we promote the careful thinking and empathy that are directly counter to the twin forces of white supremacy and toxic masculinity, which characterizes the Trump-Musk rule, referring to billionaire Elon Musk. Kaplan said that while protests against Trump have not been as visible as they were during his first term, she and many others have been active in talks with legislators and corporations, economic boycotts, and political donations. The U of I's administration has responded to the various changes, at least in part, by creating a federal update steering group of leadership, staff, faculty, and subject matter experts who are currently focused on immigration, expanding access, research funding, and impact to the university's workforce. Robin Kaler, U of I spokeswoman and chair of the group, said they're monitoring changes as they come to determine what actions the university might be required to take and what information would be helpful to impacted groups of people. People have received stop work orders and things like that, she said. We're still sorting out what those mean. We've already received the Dear Colleague letter, and we're trying to figure out what is a statement and what is a legal directive. The letter she referred to is a February 14th note from the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights regarding the U.S. Supreme Court's 2023 decision for Students for Fair Admission versus Howard, which banned consideration of race in the college admissions process. In the letter, the agency announced it would be applying that decision more broadly, saying educational institutions may neither separate or segregate students based on race, nor distribute benefits or burdens based on race. DEI programs are specifically highlighted as showing preference to certain racial groups and teaching students that certain racial groups bear unique moral burdens that others do not. Furthermore, any move to use non-racial information is a proxy for race, as foundation for a decision will be considered illegal, whether that decision is individual or systemic. It would, for instance, be unlawful for an educational institution to eliminate standardized testing to achieve a desired racial balance or to increase racial diversity, the letter said. Our legal counsel is sorting through what we need to do, Kaler said. We're looking at things like if we need to clarify that all our programs are open to everybody. For example, our cultural centers, where they may focus on a culture, are open to anyone. With many broad federal changes being applied very quickly, Kaler said a lot of concern and anxiety is being created, for people aren't sure what they mean or what to do. She said part of the U of I's goal is to help people take a breath as the administration works on navigating this, just like we did with COVID. We're going to address this, Kaler said. We're going to do it in a way that certainly follows laws, but that also continues to fulfill our mission and protects our campus community. Altar move restores church's original look. The congregation at Holy Cross Catholic Church had a new view for the Mass of St. Joseph, Mass on Wednesday evening, after the altar and other stone fixtures were moved practically overnight. Longtime churchgoers may remember that the decision to move the altar to the center is actually reverting the church to how it looked prior to 1983. Congregation member Dave Duvall said at that time local artist Harry Breen led a movement to relocate to the altar to the side of the sanctuary with the goal of making the church feel more open and light. Breen designed renovations for a total of 8 churches, including Holy Cross, which also featured some of his artwork. Monsignor Brian Brownsey, who was assigned to be pastor at Holy Cross last year, decided to have the altar moved back to the center. The altar is where our Eucharist is, where our community is, and that is supposed to be the center of everything we do, said Stephen Rank, the church's developmental coordinator director. Employees with Rich Murray Granite and Marble Works began work on moving the altar Tuesday, and by noon Wednesday they were finishing the job and cleaning up. They took the altar apart in a number of large pieces and moved them over with the help of a small crane, then reassembled everything. The ambo, or pulpit, also had to be moved a few feet to be out of the way of the altar, and a statue of the Virgin Mary was returned to the church from the parish where it had been since the 1983 renovations. While disassembling the altar, workers found a few items, including 2 relics. Rank said the church is still doing research on those items, one of which, it said, was from an unknown saint. They were both women. They were martyrs of the church, probably back in the creation of the Catholic Church. That would be my guess, Duval said. When an altar is moved in any way, it must be consecrated again. Holy Cross is hoping to have a bishop visit during the Feast of the Holy Cross in September. Rank said the church will have open hours during the Boneyard Arts Festival in early April at the request of Champaign County History Museum, which will be featuring an exhibition of Breen's work. Teacher of the Week, Tracy Parson, Kindergarten, Schneider Elementary School, Blue Ridge. Little Lessons. For 28 years, Tracy Parson has worked to enthrall students in the Blue Ridge School District. Whether her students are getting their hands dirty or writing letters to the older students of the school to catch a lost gingerbread man, kindergartners at Schneider Elementary are always kept occupied and engaged. I find my work important because so many things make my job important. It's more than teaching children how to read or do math. It's helping them learn about themselves, problem solve, advocate for themselves, work in a group, believe in their own abilities, follow directions, and to learn to be all-around good human beings. It's building relationships with students and families in a positive and lasting way. I have students in my class who are what I call legacies, meaning I had their parents, and that is just an amazing blessing for me. Makes me feel old, but still a blessing. I became a teacher because I've always wanted to be a teacher, specifically a teacher of littles. Since I was about 7 years old, I knew I wanted to be. My favorite or most unique lesson that I teach is, I have a lot of these, but my favorite one recently has been our gingerbread man unit. We read the book and make individual gingerbread cookies for a snack that afternoon. Unfortunately, they ran away, and we sit down together as a family and make a plan about what to do about our missing gingerbread men. We write a letter to the school letting them know what happened and asking for their help. We then go to different classrooms and read the letter and get their thoughts. We make missing posters and hang them up, and then finally we make traps or gingerbread houses to catch them. They do eventually come back, but not until the end of the week. It takes an entire week to get through each part, but it is worth it. It's one of my favorite projects or lessons because it not only involves so many aspects of teaching, writing, public speaking, problem solving, but the kids absolutely love it, and the whole school gets involved. I have kids from other grades catching me in the hall to let me know that they've seen our gingerbread men. So much fun. My most fulfilling moments on the job are when I would say the aha moments, the moments when you've been teaching a concept or working with a student who is struggling in an area, and then they just get it. I think I see more of those moments teaching kindergarten than I have in any other grade. I keep students engaged by, I believe learning in kindergarten should be a full body experience. When we learn about plants and science, we have our hands in the dirt. We are planting seeds and recording information, and we are even tasting the different parts of a plant from root to flower. When you can involve different modalities in your lessons, you are able to get more engagement and learning. Also, listening to what your students are interested in and bringing that into the classroom helps with engagement as well. Something else I'm passionate about is my family. I've been married for over 30 years to my husband, Noel, and we have two adult children, Nathaniel and Emily. Nathaniel is getting married next fall, and Emily is applying to law school. I love hanging out with them, playing games, or just chatting. My favorite teacher and subject to teach in school was, oh my, that is taking me back a bit. I would have to say either Mr. Parker from fifth grade at Bentley Elementary in New Lenox, or Mr. Huddleston, who taught freshman English at Lincoln Way Central High School. And my favorite subjects are math and child development. If I weren't a teacher, I would be a children's librarian or own my own bakery. I love to read and I love to bake. And we have Matt Hale's Records and Radio column, celebrating Larry Lujak's powerful morning voice. Plenty of feedback, comments, and questions follow our pieces about morning radio shows, but first a quiz question. I've been asking Women's History Month quiz questions on air. Tina Turner's solo career took off in the 1980s. Name Tina's first worldwide solo hit. It was a cover of a Billboard Hot 100 number one song. Answer at the end of my column. Thanks, John Fazil, supplying the answer for Rick Bednar regarding former WDWS personality Gary Axelson. John shared, I worked with Gary for about 6 months before he left, heading to Washington, D.C. He was a good guy and a lot of fun. He was hired by Metro Media, covering a variety of national and international beats. After an award-winning stint in D.C. local television, he made a career switch. His long-desired goal was to be a clinical psychologist, getting his doctorate from George Mason University in 1984. He then began a career with Fairfax County Community Services Board, working in emergency services. Gary lost a 10-year battle with multiple myeloma, passing on February 13, 2025. Several readers inquired about Gibson City native Don Morning Munson's show at WJBC in Bloomington. He attended the University of Illinois and worked at 1580 WKID in Urbana. In 1964, he was hired at WJBC as a news reporter. In 1965, he started a 35-year run as one of the most successful morning personalities in the country, consistently delivering a commanding 40-plus share of the McLean County morning radio audience. Late in 1974, I was a new resident in McLean County when I worked for the Broadcast Automation Company, SMC. Listening to Don's show, I quickly understood why he had a national acclaim. His show was the heartbeat of Bloomington Normal. Late in 1974, I saw a new resident of McLean County went to work for the Broadcast Automation Company, SMC. Listening to Don's show, Jamie Nyberg grew up around Peoria with two legendary personalities playing every morning in her home during breakfast time. Mom and Dad faithfully had WMBD's Don Bob Carlton on the house. The house rules, the kitchen radio must never be switched from WMBD. Jamie and her sister would only listen to rock and roll WIRL's Robin Weaver in their bedroom. Thus, that's where the sisters ate breakfast. By the way, both Bob and Robin had extraordinary radio voices. Dr. Paul Stein sent me plenty of material about his favorite morning personality, Larry Lujack at WLS. Wally Phillips ruled the early morning waves at WGN for two decades, from the mid-1960s to the mid-80s. But it's Superjock's just over 10-year run in WLS mornings that is still talked about today. Lujack's top 40 timeline in Chicago started at WCFL during overnights in 1967. 4 months later, he crossed the street to do afternoons at WLS. His first shot as the WLS morning jock was in 1970, but by 1972, he got a big money offer to go back to WCFL for afternoons. After WCFL switched to beautiful music, Larry executed the format perfectly to fulfill his WCFL contract. He then went back to the Big 89 in 1976 for another highly successful run in radio mornings. Among the popular offerings, Clunk Letter of the Day, Cheap Trashy Showbiz News, Police Beat, Uncle Lair's editorials, and of course, the highly acclaimed Animal Stories with Little Snot-Nosed Tommy. Decades later, Lujack fans still quote their favorite moments from his show. His supporting cast of Les Grobstein, Jeffrey Hendricks, Lyle Dean, Catherine Johns, and others were perfect targets for Larry's humor. Back in the day, all the WLS jocks zigzagged a 150-mile radius of Chicago, making appearances everywhere. Listeners have shown me copies of posters and ads where Uncle Lair stopped by CU's Red Lion Brown Jug, and chances are. This has been Mary Moreland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, March 20th, 2025. Please stay tuned for Part 2.